So this morning we're continuing our series on John's Gospel, which is running on and off throughout the year. The four Gospels cover Jesus' life and death from three perspectives, really. What Jesus did, what Jesus said, and who Jesus was. John is mainly concerned with the third of these things, who Jesus was. And he sets out his stall from the very beginning of the Gospel. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. And that's John 1:1-3, and the comparison that I've got is Genesis 1:1, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. So this is what John wants us to understand, that Jesus is the Son of God, wholly divine, wholly human, and his gospel is edited with that in mind. Maybe not so difficult for us to understand with 200 years of hindsight, libraries of books. But at the time, he could have been seen as one of the many wandering preachers and teachers that were about. And of course, at the time of these events, even John didn't fully understand what was going on. When he wrote his gospel, the other three gospels had already been written and had documented Jesus' birth, what he did, what happened, and what he said. But in John's gospel, there are perhaps some surprising omissions. There's no word about his baptism, his temptations, casting out of demons, transfiguration, the Last Supper, struggle in prayer in Gethsemane, or even the Ascension. These didn't appear to be part of John's purpose in writing his gospel. But he did include miracles. Not the number of miracles in the Synoptic Gospels, where they proliferate, particularly not miracles of demon possession, as there were others that also were practicing this at the time. But if we were to do a survey of Jesus' most well-known miracles in the same sense that we do Ruddington's favourite carol, feeding the 5,000 and walking on water would be right up there as some of the best known, I think. But his miracles that are in the gospel are only seven. And John doesn't call them miracles. He calls them signs. So in his gospel, we find seven signs. Signs point to something. When we are driving and our sat-nav is turned off, mine normally is, we use road signs to show us the way. They point us in the direction we need to go and show us that other roads, sometimes more attractive or bigger, are not the right way. They're not the right direction. These signs are the clues to where John is leading us, and they are leading us to the view that Jesus is the Son of God. As an ex-investigator and looking back with hindsight, I often think of these miracles as evidence that Jesus is what God claims. Now, signs to me sometimes seems a bit woolly. You know, well, it's there, it's sort of pointing you in the right direction. But evidence is there in black and white, it's strong, it's definite, and it's been tested. And this is the proof of the claim. So we need to look at the signs and evidence carefully. John has given us seven signs. The other Gospels have given us many more miracles, often repeated amongst the three. John's signs stand out because only two of them feature in the other Gospels. The other five stand alone and only appear in his gospel. So what are we to make of that? If John is carefully editing what he writes to prove that Jesus is the Son of God, then we have to look carefully at things that he puts into his gospel that appear elsewhere. Which means that basically, if John included them, then they must be important to him, and therefore to us, and they must point directly at Jesus being the Son of God. So the first of today's two signs, the feeding of the 5,000, is actually the only miracle to appear in all four Gospels. So John must really think this is important. Otherwise he would leave it out, because he's left out a load of other stuff. It's well documented in the other Gospels. Why include it? Because it clearly points to Jesus, and it has a historical basis as well. It refers back to God feeding the Israelites when they were in the desert following the escape from Egypt. And this would be understood by John's readers. So John has already linked Jesus to God in the opening of the gospel by mirroring Genesis. And here he draws their attention back to Exodus and to Moses. The crowd would understand this, and they would understand this because, first of all, they're near to the Jewish feast of Passover. And the Passover is the time where they remember what happened when they were leaving Egypt. A time when the Jews celebrate deliverance from Egypt and Moses leading them to the promised land. A time when God fed them in the wilderness with manna. And so John is therefore drawing again a direct comparison between history and what happened in the Old Testament and what's happening now. So Jesus had crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee to get away from a crowd of people who'd seen miraculous signs, miracles that he'd performed healing the sick. He went up to a mountain, sat down with his disciples, and the crowd came towards him. They followed him. And as he saw them following him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" I think if I'd had a day, and I never have, healing people, doing miraculous things, I think my first reaction might have been, "God, give me a break. I haven't got a moment to myself." But that wasn't Jesus' reaction. Jesus' reaction was, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" And he asked that question of Philip. Now, why Philip in particular? He doesn't get much of a mention in any of the Gospels, to be honest. And the reason seems to be that Philip came from around there. So it's no good asking me where I'm going to get food or buy a loaf in Grantham, because I don't know. I haven't been around there. But Philip is around there. He's going to know about things. And his answer was not, "Well, you do it, Jesus," or "Don't worry about it." His answer is, 8 months' wages wouldn't be enough. Well, I did a quick calculation myself. Well, it wasn't quick, because it took me a while to work out how much flour and time it would take to make enough bread to feed 5,000 people. And I reckon we'd need something like 1,250 loaves. Slightly more than a daily lunch pack. But probably, so that's, if we were to make that, that would be over 600 kilos of flour. For people who don't do kilos, that's over half a ton. And each loaf would take 3 or 4 hours to make. So you can imagine this is a mammoth task. And people looking at this task would think, my goodness, how are we going to sort all this out? And Philip has obviously understood that it's a really huge task because he's given a price for it. And the price is like 6 months' wages. But he hasn't quite realized what Jesus is going to do or what Jesus can do. And yet, Philip has seen the miracles that have happened. And seen in the recent past Jesus healing people, but he hasn't quite yet twigged who Jesus is or what Jesus can do if we give him the opportunity. So I guess a question for us and a question for me is, have we forgotten who Jesus is and what Jesus can do? But have we looked at a task that's too big for us and thought, wow, this is just too big. I can't do this. I think I too regularly forget who Jesus is and what he can do. When the world's problems get a bit much, when my problems get a bit much, and they come one on top of the other. Then we have Andrew, Peter's brother, introducing a boy who had only 5 small barley loaves and 2 fish. He wants to know how far they will go among so many. And here's another one who's missed the point and trying to limit Jesus as well. He seems to have forgotten what Jesus can do given the chance. But here is a young boy prepared to give his own food, however little, so that others can eat, like Megan. And he's probably not sure what Jesus will do with it either. But he's ready to be used and to give what he has in any case. I remember being at school when I was about 13, when our religious education leader went off sick. And we had some supply teachers around, one of whom was a minister in some obscure place, but nevertheless was wearing a dog collar and taught us for some while. And the only memorable lesson that I remember from him was about the feeding of the 5,000. But it was memorable only because his view was that the example of the young boy sharing his food with the disciples was an example to the crowd to share the food that they had with each other. No sense that the crowd had been so carried away by the miraculous healings they'd seen that they'd forgotten about food. No sense that something miraculous was happening here. No sense that Jesus was anything but a man. A good man, but not a miracle worker, and definitely not the Son of God. But I was at a school here where you wouldn't challenge something like that. At least you wouldn't overtly challenge something like that. But also not a time where I was prepared to believe everything I was told, even by somebody who, to me, looked like a vicar. And I was quite affronted, really, that somebody was trying to tell me that Jesus didn't perform miracles, that there were logical and worldly explanations for all of this. But I don't think, really, that John gives us that option. Jesus took the loaves, gave thanks, and then handed them over. So much abundance that there were 12 baskets left over. But here's a slight contrast from the manna from heaven. The Israelites were not allowed to collect it and store it. It went rotten, except when being stored for the Sabbath. The Israelites were forced to believe that God would keep on providing for them. And so they were forced to rely on him on a daily basis. It wasn't just a one-off, well, let's feed everybody and then they can all go away and do something else. This was an everyday thing that they needed to trust in God every day. And perhaps that's something we can learn from this as well, that we need to trust God every day. Well, any significance to the 12 baskets? I don't know. The commentaries that I've looked at have said, well, maybe it's the 12 tribes of Israel. Maybe it's just that there were 12 disciples going around picking up all the stuff. We don't know, and we don't know what happened to the baskets afterwards. So there we are. But harking back to Moses and his time again, after the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, surely this is the prophet who has come into the world. Deuteronomy 18, 18 and 19 says, I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their brothers. I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him. If anyone does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name, I myself will call him to account. This is God talking to Moses. And here are the crowd living under Roman rule, eagerly awaiting the Messiah, the leader who could liberate them. The miraculous signs that they saw led them to believe that Jesus was that man. If he could heal the sick and feed the hungry, then surely he was the man to free them from Rome. They wanted to start a revolution with Jesus as king. Of course, Jesus wanted to start a revolution as well, but not against the Roman Empire, but against sin, immorality, hypocrisy. Jesus was wise to the ideas of the crowd and withdrew to a mountain. In verse 26, he told them, I tell you the truth, you are looking for me, not because you saw miraculous signs, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill. So what are the lessons from this that we can learn for us today? And I think Sam's probably suggested most of them. But let me suggest the ones that I'd written down beforehand. Jesus can do anything from a little, but he can do nothing from nothing. We have to offer the little that we have in order for him to do his great things. And then he will do more than we can ever dream of. I once bought a house in Brabourne. I didn't realise at the time that actually I was buying a manse. And I only realised it when I had to go into the lawyers and sign a second set of papers, because the minister at the Baptist church only owned half the manse and the rest of it was owned by the church. So I had to do two lots of papers. And I was quite happy doing that. And I found out a bit later, talking to people, that they had prayed for a Christian to buy the manse. And actually, at the time, I wasn't a Christian, but I became one solely because I buy the manse. And I thought, here we are. Here's a set of Christians who are praying for something and are limiting God, asking God to do something without realizing that he could do something even better, rather than selling a house to somebody in the kingdom. He was selling a house and bringing people into the kingdom. And that's a lesson that we need to learn, and a lesson that we can see here, because we need to be careful as well that we don't try and turn Jesus into something that he doesn't want to be. We don't want to shape Jesus into what we want. We need to allow Jesus to be what he wants to be. The crowd tried to make Jesus king, not because of who he was, but because of what he did. But today's reading, as they say, is a game of two halves. And the first sign was a sign to many people. The second miracle was a miracle just to the disciples. The second sign in the reading also appears in Matthew and Mark. So again, John thought this was an important pointer to who Jesus was and was so important that he put it in his gospel. When evening came, the disciples went down to the lake, got into a boat, and sailed across the lake to Capernaum. It was dark and the wind got up. Some of these men were fishermen before becoming disciples, so the idea of getting into a boat and crossing a lake wouldn't be a concern to them. They're just doing their day job, really, or what was their day job. They'd been out in rough weather before, so it wasn't unusual. But if they got worried and concerned about what was going on, then the situation really must have been pretty bad. I remember going on a sailing holiday in Greece where the weather turned really nasty. We had a long trip along the coast with nowhere to put in before our destination. And the wind really got up and the waves were pretty high, I'm told. I was terrified and very grateful to get into port safely later in the evening. The whole of my shirt was white from the salt that had landed on there. When I mentioned this to some other sailors, they said, "Well, we sail out of Oven. It's like this all the time. We had a great day." And I spoke to somebody else, another couple, and they said, "When we get back, we are never going in a sailing boat again." Others, like me, were just grateful to be in port, and I seriously could have done with Jesus in the boat. Because I really, at some point in time, didn't think we were going to get there. But the interesting thing here is that the same circumstances have completely different effects on people. And it's not always possible to know or guess what they may be, or how people are living, or what people are living through. But each reaction obviously will be valid for the people who've lived through it. The disciples saw Jesus walking on the water and were terrified. So if things hadn't got bad because there was storms and everything else, they now saw this strange figure and saw Jesus, and that hasn't really helped the matter at the moment. They are still absolutely terrified. Yep. They're terrified in the middle of a storm and they see something coming towards them. They see Jesus. But they've just seen Jesus feeding 5,000 people with five loaves and two fishes. A crowd tried to make him king and overthrow Roman rule, and now he's walking on water. But once they invite him into the boat, the storm stills and they reach the shore safely. How does that make us feel about the situation we feel ourselves in today? How does that make us feel when the situation around us is really getting horrific and we think we can't cope very well? Tomorrow starts Mental Health Awareness Week with the emphasis on loneliness. Feelings of loneliness and isolation have gone up threefold since the pandemic, especially amongst young people. Loneliness is estimated to have cost businesses £2.5 billion in lost revenue. So how is our mental health at the moment? How is my mental health at the moment? Well, my own mental health is probably as bad as it's been for some time, possibly a very long time. If you ask Karen how I've changed in the time that she's known me, she may well say, he has less hair now and it's a lot whiter. I blame her. But she's more likely to say, he's a lot more open now than he used to be. And I am more open with my feelings than I've ever been. From a child, I've been advised, persuaded by my mother to be wary, to not invite people into my house, to not reveal my feelings to people, and that hasn't been helpful through my life. In my job, for my own personal safety, I've been very careful about revealing what I do, how I feel, where I live, and I haven't had many friends most of the time because it's difficult to have friends when every time they invite you to do something, you say, terribly sorry, I've got to go to work. After a while, they stop asking you. And so those feelings of isolation and loneliness have increased in me, and that seems to be a position that every day I fight against. And we seem to have isolated ourselves physically at the cost of our mental health. I've managed to avoid getting COVID. I'm one of the lucky ones. I've had my injections. But the isolation and the luck of not getting COVID has come at the cost of my mental health. And it's come at the cost of a lot of other people's mental health as well. And now we've got to deal with the situation in Ukraine, energy prices going up, they're going to go up even more in October, there's another cost of living crisis, and there's an ongoing climate emergency. There's examinations coming up for the young people in this country, and stress has been going on, uncertainty has been going on, war has been going on for a long time. While I was thinking about this, I realised that 40 years ago, and not everybody here is 40 years old, but 40 years ago today, there was a task force sailing to the Falkland Islands to fight a war. Some of this stuff is so distressing. Some of this stuff is so difficult. And some of it is so difficult that actually I have to edit the news. I used to watch BBC News every night. But I can't do it anymore. I have to go to the website because it allows you to edit what you see. And it's difficult not to get overloaded by this storm around us. It's difficult not to retreat into isolation and loneliness, especially as that has been my default position for so long, since childhood. So the question I want to ask now and think about for a moment is, where is Jesus in this storm? Well, Jesus is there walking alongside them, walking towards them, but he has to be invited into the boat. And that can be equally frightening. When the disciples saw Jesus walking on water towards him, they were terrified. They just had something else to deal with when their minds were overloaded. But asking Jesus into the boat with them was the first step. Mental health problems can't always be solved for other people. Christians love to problem solve, but it's not always possible. Mental health issues within the wider church have now become more accepted, but it's recent. And I think COVID has caused that. The old idea that finding Jesus will give you a happy life and you aren't allowed to be depressed because Jesus is with you have gone. And it's important for churches to buy into this. Three or four years ago, I was invited to think about where the church was going to be 2 years from then, 5 years from then, 10 years from then, and 20 years from then. And people were being very optimistic about where they thought the church was in 2 years' time. And I thought that the church probably wouldn't have moved much in 2 years. I'm not talking about RBC, because I think RBC has got a grip of this from a while ago. My view was that in 2 years' time, the church would be waking up to the problem of mental health and how to deal with people. And I think we've taken two important steps on that. And that are the Renew projects that we have running, both of them. A cafe which meets and Renew Green Spaces which meet on a Monday lunchtime. Where is Jesus with these? Well, he's in the boat with us. Both these projects are surrounded by prayer. But after all, it's a come-as-you-are space where you don't have to be mentally well to come, where you're accepted in the space that you're in. And it's about relationship. It's about relationship with each other. We may not be able to cure you, but we can walk alongside you for a bit.